hobos and the ashes of a condemned warehouse. Sound familiar? A few zombies wander onto a few Greyhound buses and die in the night between Tyler and Killeen? Are you getting the idea? Well, anyway, I guess I can tide you over. Okay, all right, let's see here. 548 wants to know, why do the thing always bad? And then it meanders off on some daisy talk. All right, 548, I'm a doctor, so I think I can make some sense out of your gibberish. Counterbalancing the luck plane, that's what you want to know. All right, okay. The fabric sags and you're knee-deep in your own soil. Well, the first thing you need to do is locate the fulcrum of the immediate luck plane. Simple machines, we've been over this. All right, examples, okay. I know you guys don't get out much, but, well, frankly, I can't relate to you shut-ins. Okay, example. I'm in the car, late for something, and catching every red light. All right, we need counterbalance. What I'll do is I'll throw my miniature nicotine delivery systems into the back seat. Okay, now I can't reach them unless I hit a red light. Well, that doesn't do it. I'm still hitting red lights. Okay, pitch the tape you're listening to. Check your portafropper back there. Sunglasses, your works. Keep in mind that the stuff in the back seat is not the fulcrum. It is the counterbalance. The fulcrum is your desire for the stuff in the back seat. The lever, of course, is always present. Eventually, depending on the inclination of your tilt, all the crap you need in the back seat will tilt the plane and ensure that you do not hit any red lights to give you an opportunity to grab your stuff. I must stress that you must leave the counterbalance in place. In other words, don't grab the stuff back if you do happen to hit a red light. Unless, of course, you now need the stuff in the back seat more than you need to get where you're going. In which case, well, you're out of luck. All right, now that better hold you. We'll work on switching out the pills, but until then, shut up!
I'd like to welcome our listening audience tonight. Listen to Bob Sighttown Funhouse, the local Atlanta Seguin's Radio Minister Rally. So welcome our co-hosts tonight, Reverend Dr. Piel, Reverend Dr. Begwetter, and other people we have. Please introduce yourself. Tell us who you have tonight.
I'm the doctor's patient,
said man.
I'm the
patient.
Oh, I didn't have words of room.
Hey, what can you say, you know?
I feel like that, you know. I mean,
I've got
Dr. Frank Whitley in the house. I think I see him over there.
Hello, Frank, would you like to say something?
No, that's okay.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much.
Research in the corner.
Agents active.
My son's family and I went to Disney World in Orlando 2 years ago.
Yeah.
And we didn't realize it, but the day that we went down there, I found out later they call it Gay Day.
Oh no.
Encouraged the homosexuals.
No. You were there, Melba?
I was there on that day, and it was the worst experience of my life.
Can you tell me what you saw? I mean, some of this you probably can't describe on a family show.
Well, that's true. We saw several things that just were shocking. But the worst part of it was, besides just, you know, it was like these people would kiss openly, you know, and embrace. But if we gave them a funny look, they would say rude things to us.
So when they were kissing, they're the ones doing the weird things.
Right.
But if you look at them funny, then they get mad at you.
Oh, yes. They were very hateful. And the worst part of it was, I have a nephew who is a teenager. He went off and rode the rides and things by himself all day long.
Yeah.
When we met him back there at the pavilion and we all got back together, he had a little friend with him, a boy a year or two older, and this young boy that, and he said, I met a new...
The young boy is going to have to wait, because coming up next on Free Radio Santa Cruz at 96.3 FM is Bathrobes, Piers, Broadsides. Civil Rights for the Poor. Stay with us for 2 hours of fun, games, and special guest star, beast, Nutcracker Mick Whitehead.
Now I sympathize with the homeless when I see them on the evening news. Somewhere there must be a place where they can park their weary shoes. Maybe a camp in the country or a building on the edge of town. But that shelter there across the street is only gonna get me down. Everybody should have a home. Everybody must be fed. Everyone has a right to a roof and below it a nice warm bed. We applaud your noble efforts at guarding your collective health, and we'll gladly give you funds and food long as you can put them somewhere else. See, I don't want to have to lock my door, be inside, safe inside. This neighborhood will go to pot with the likes of them around. It's no fun out there in the cold. Yes, I know just how they feel, but I just can't bear to see a hungry face when I'm eating a nice warm meal. Oh, everybody should have a home. Everybody must be fed. Everyone has a right to a roof and load a nice warm bed. We applaud your noble efforts at guarding the collective health, and we'll gladly give you friends and food long as you can put them somewhere else. I've got a friend who owns a store about a half a block away. Every year she donates goods and money to United Way. But she thinks it's bad for business to have the homeless walking by. She says, why not send them south for the winter so they can stay warm and dry? Oh, everybody should have a home. Everybody must be fed. Everyone has a right to a roof and a lower than nice warm bed. We applaud your noble efforts at guarding their collective health, and we'll gladly give you funds and food long as you can put them somewhere else. Well, now please understand our position. It's not the way it looks. Want them housed but out of sight. There are zoning laws on the books. Long as we can clear our conscience and preserve our civic pride, we'll give our consent, even pay the rent on a place where they can hide. Cause everybody should have a home. Everybody must be fed. Everyone has a right to a roof and below it a nice warm bed. We applaud your noble efforts at guarding their collective health, and we'll gladly give you funds and food long as you can put them somewhere else. Yes, we'll gladly give you funds and food long as you can put them somewhere else.
And that was Mark Levy from his Take Off Your Clothes album back in 1986, which you can still get a copy of if you like, from New Clear Records up in Felton, California, P.O. Box 559. Give him a call at 338-7283 and order now today. Order 10 or 15 copies if you can.
Oh, well, Take Off Your Clothes, is that what it's called?
In the guest with me, I know, in the studio with me. Well,
Take Off Your Clothes, that's what I heard.
Is, my God, what is your name anyway?
Nutcracker Nick.
Nutcracker Nick Whitehead, actually. He and I co-founded SPAN, lo these many years ago. SPAN, of course, stands for...
Superb Polishing Accessories Nutrients.
Actually, it stands for Stop Police Abuse Now, Nick. Let's kid around here. This is Bathroom Spears Broadsides you're listening to for all of you who are unfortunate enough not to regularly follow the show and just kind of wandered in on your radio dial. This is a show about civil rights in Santa Cruz and actually in other cities as well, particularly focusing on poor and homeless people, folks most likely to find the business end of a police billy club in a more intimate relationship.
this
give the people a hand, don't give them a fist.
Yes, Nick, of course, is always ready with an aphorism to deal with the latest crisis.
Right.
And we're going to ask him for an aphorism to deal with the Happy John Dine slang, as well as the destruction of the homeless Pelton Street, Pelton Garden Project situation. And we have numerous questions for Nick, actually, in a more serious vein, or possibly a more comic vein, depending on...
Thank you. I speak five languages, terribly.
Yes, and you're going to hear probably each of those five languages more than you would want to hear. The show goes on from 6 to 8 for all you folks who are clock watchers, and if you want to call in, you're out of luck. We still don't have our phones hooked up. However, we can get messages off air, and we can respond to them if you have any of you who ever had the intro to call us. And that number to call, of course, is 423-HUFF, 423-4833. HUFF is an acronym for exactly, for Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom, which is the group I belong to. And actually, Nick has had some associations with that group, probably to his dismay. If you want to leave a message at 423-HUFF, we will broadcast your reactions to anything you hear on the air, any announcements you want to make regarding civil rights for the poor, and of course that next show, which you will be able to be a part of, because you can't be a part of this one except by listening, is going to be happening on Sunday at 11 o'clock, runs till 1:30 here on 96.3 FM Free Radio Santa Cruz. Also, if you want to get in touch with the radio station itself to broadcast a general public service announcement or possibly air a tape, and I hope you're listening.
Tape some air. Let's tape some air.
Yes, tapes. If you've got a tape, Tom Reveille, if you're listening, Tom is a man who wants to be on the radio. I know. I hope you're listening to this broadcast, Tom.
Okay.
Send in a tape to Free Radio Santa Cruz, and let's air that before the collective. Air it on the air, and maybe we'll get some air, and we'll air it out.
Yeah.
If you want to. Contact Free Radio, 427-4523 is their voicemail, and that's frsc@cruzio.com for those of you lucky enough to have email.
Somebody's bursting in.
And we have...
there's a guest.
Someone is bursting into the studio. It's the FCC, right? No, just kidding, folks. The FCC luckily continues to maintain a discreet distance. One of our mystery guests has mysteriously shown up.
Oh, God, the guy's so ugly, he's brought me.
And, of course, he's getting a complete shakedown from a nutcracker.
He's bad, man.
Who has been not only monitoring the police, but every individual you can think of for the last two decades. Why don't we begin, Nick, to talk to you, I don't know which persona you're going to use here, but you have, in fact, been one of the co-founders of SPAN, Stop Police Abuse Now, back in 1990.
Yep.
And you've been taking a particular interest in a number of recent cases. You want to give us an update on what you've heard from the streets?
Sure. Just want to update you, about a month ago I told listeners that I invited listeners to attend a court case. I've forgotten the name of the man, but he was suffering from bipolar disorder, and police had come to his house and forcibly arrested him and thrown him on the ground and swung him into the metal of their squad car.
These are Santa Cruz police, or?
Yeah. And
do we have any names of these turkeys?
No, we never did trace the names.
The upshot of this was... But because he'd been so abused by the police, the judge took a very lenient attitude and didn't want to prosecute him beyond a certain point.
What was he being charged with, and who was the
judge? Well, of course, you know, whenever the police abuse somebody, then the victim is charged with something like resisting arrest. And in this case, he was. But what interested me about this case is, since his arrest, he had received some treatment and medication for his bipolar disorder. So the police had failed to recognize a medical condition, though the man's girlfriend was trying to inform them of the same.
Well, of course, the police seem to be failing to recognize a number of medical conditions. I think we had a report in yesterday's Sentinel or the day before about a man died in jail. His name was after having been arrested for drunk, taken to Dominican, and again replaced in jail. So they seem to have a few problems, at least the sheriff's and the jails department does in this regard. But apparently the Santa Cruz Police Department, you say, also is engaged in abusive behavior around this, as far as you understand?
Yeah, this was the Santa Cruz Police. And at that time I reminded people that the police do often get involved with off-duty security guards from from the boardwalk facility down in Beach Flats. And these like are wannabe cops who haven't quite made the grade, but they are in uniform of the boardwalk, and they like to go along with the cops, particularly when there's some action and an extra body is needed. And in this case, the police had allowed this man to take part in the assault on the man they were trying to arrest. This wannabe cop situation is very unhealthy, in my opinion.
You also have expressed some concerns, as have I, of course, repeatedly on the station about the Happy John Dine slaying back on November 12th. A developmentally disabled man was shot dead by a police officer, Connor right. Carey, allegedly for brandishing a toy gun. Right. I think I wrote, readers of City on the Hill Press have read my latest take on this in an editorial from last week, City on the Hill Press. And I believe that next week, not this Friday, but next Friday, there will be an edition coming out of City on the Hill that talks about the editor's own analysis of that situation. He interviewed me yesterday. I think he's going to interview Bill Christie, head of the Citizens Police Review Board, tomorrow. Citizens Police Review Board, of course, for all of you fellows with calluses on your asses and got to have a lot of patience to listen to that CPRB. Folks who have that kind of patience might want to show up at the CPRB at 5:30. They meet on Monday, the second Monday of every month, and that's this upcoming Monday, at City Hall at 5:30 in the evening, and you can give them a piece of your mind. I think rotten vegetables are quite suitable under these circumstances, though I've never done that myself. I wouldn't want to ask someone to do something that I'm not willing to do. And
pineapples. They're big.
Big pineapples, right. But you were talking about problems in the police force that you saw exemplified by what happened around the Happy John Dine slaying, not just the question of whether Carey himself was culpable, let's say, of murder or involuntary homicide, but rather you talked about the general policies of the police department in terms of shoot to kill, that sort of thing.
It's interesting that Officer Carey, I believe, is the one who arrested Big Dave, the famous Big Dave, who was a former Marine protesting the original Gulf War.
Wanton Dave Jacobs,
yeah. Mm-hmm. I think that officer was the one who arrested him, and I think he caused a lot of pain to Dave while he did it. And Dave told me, he said, Carey said to him, why are you such a soft guy? You may have been in the Marines, but I was in the Special Forces, commando units. Mm-hmm.
So now he's using his skills on locals. I suppose that's a form of on-the-job training or some such thing.
The shoot to kill, you asked me about that. when John Dine was slain on the street, on the bloodstained street of our own city, one of the first people I called up was a police officer training academy over the hill in Santa Clara County. Spoke to the top guy. I asked him about the shoot-to-kill policy. He said most police departments, nearly all, have it. And it's not only if the person is carrying a firearm and who may be a threat to public safety. They can shoot to kill if there is a knife or what even looks like a knife. So it could apply to firearm, toy gun, what looks like a knife, maybe even other implements. Shoot to kill, they're allowed to do that if a person is driving a motor vehicle recklessly, too. The people who make these decisions are not the public. They're made by a state commission on police officer standards and training. And if people want to get together and organize on those, on that score, we would have to have a campaign aimed at the makeup of that body.
Well, you know, last time that organizing happened around any of these issues in any extensive way, of course, was the Coalition for a Citizens Police Review Commission, which gave us our current, we can't bother with public hearings, to heck with an independent investigation, let's not even hold a hearing in the month after John Dine was slain, Citizens Police Review Board, the one we have now. And you, I guess, were a part of that effort to establish the Citizens Police Review Board. Have they, and certainly I imagine you brought some of these questions to the board before now about shooting, or have you? I know you brought the pepper spray issue to the board.
No, I brought the pepper spray issue before the CPRB. And it's interesting little footnote here. the same legislator in Sacramento who brought us the pepper spray is the very same legislator who is trying to get fluoride in our water. Jackie Speier, State Assembly, is just one of those people with a pernicious sense of what's wrong and then insists on doing it. She represents chemical industries.
Well, that's interesting. I have no no absence of criticism for folks engaging in, at a state level in behaviors I think are counterproductive to basic rights of citizens here. Fluoride may be a fine thing, and people may want it on their teeth, but should it be put into the waters and forced upon folks who don't want it? That's a real question that apparently the city council is turning thumbs down at the moment, in spite of Cynthia Matthews and columnist Lee Kornstrom's interest in having the compulsory fluoridation of the water. But that's and the issue that I'm really looking at here briefly, yeah. Since you are here as a SPAN rep, Stop Police Abuse Now, which, by the way, if folks have complaints they want to bring to you, I guess they can give you a call at 475-2012?
Yeah, 475-2012. And one matter we're looking at right now is Brad Miles, who he lives in a camper vehicle in the Ocean Street area, and told one of our representatives that the police put a bag over his head and held him down near the exhaust pipe of their squad car, patrol car. I called up the Citizens Police Review Board, and I was told the police do indeed have these bags, but the way they're supposed to be used is if they think the person has AIDS or some other communicable disease and might spit in their face, then they can put a bag over their head. They're not supposed to try and get exhaust gases up a person's nose. I don't know if this fellow interpreted it that way. He was alcoholic. He may have fallen down. I want to meet him, and if anybody knows Brad Miles, I'd like to talk with him.
And do give a call to Nick Whitehead of Stop Police Abuse Now at 475-2012, 475-2012, if you're interested in that. We want to talk more about these issues, particularly I wanted to get your take on a couple of other things, Nick, like the Rotkin-Norse debate on the sleeping ban issue.
Why don't you interview Chris for a while, and I'll come back and gladly give a blow-by-blow account of the fabulous wrestling match that took place on the campus.
It was quite a historic occasion. Yeah, I appreciate you're doing that. Yeah, we do have another guest in the studio, Chris Jennings, notorious in his own right as a man with a numerous political causes that he's championed. Maybe you can give us a little background on yourself, Chris, for those who aren't familiar with you. Probably more people familiar with you than they are familiar with me because of the work you've been doing in the community. What have you been up to for the last few years, and what are your current interests that might interest our listeners?
In the past few years, I've tried to get involved with a number of people in the community who've been doing quite amazing work, from everything from the single-payer health care campaign to Bill Monning's congressional race and state assembly campaign. Various work with organizations like the Santa Cruz Action Network and Regional Alliance for Progressive Policy.
Yeah.
And I was inspired by working with people like Bill Monning and local activists to go to law school and try to learn about the legal system and where the pressure points are and where we can find room to make progressive social change. And so I've been in law school. I'm currently a law student, and for the past 6 months I've been heavily involved with a great group of Santa Cruz City residents who are trying to stop the city council from selling public land and destroying the homeless garden project.
You want to give us a little of the background on that? We've actually played, I think, your remarks to city council, and we played different excerpts from attempts of the public to educate the city council and urge them back onto the path of, at least representing what seems to be the will of what is likely to be a majority of the voters that your recently, it's not completely established initiative. It hasn't been established finally until what all the signatures are counted and so forth. But give us a bit of the background, summarize it for those folks who don't know what's going on, and kick a little butt.
Well, there's a really rich history in this county. The Pelton Street property, the city has owned this land since the 1960s. In 1974, the citizens of Santa Cruz got together to try to fight the city council at that time, which was trying to put a convention center in Lighthouse Field. So the citizens gathered and put together the first successful initiative in Santa Cruz County history, and they stopped the development of the Lighthouse Field with convention center, and the Pelton Street property was going to be utilized as a parking lot for that convention center. So from 1975 to 1990, the land was used as community gardens. Neighbors in the Williams James Company put in piping for water, they put in community gardens, and for 25 years it's been used for community gardens. In 1990, importantly, the city leased the land to the Homeless Garden Project. And in the last 8 years, this project has evolved beyond anyone's wildest imagination. It's been recognized on the floor of the U.S. Senate. It's been nationally recognized recently. A number of AmeriCorps volunteers have been hired to work at the garden. But the city, since 1990, has been talking about whether or not they're going to sell this land and theorizing about it, speculating about it. In 1990, they subdivided the land amidst a lot of public contention and outrage. And since that time, they've talked about selling it, but it was in January of 1997 that Scott Kennedy, in a non-agendized budget meeting with the council, he established that he wanted a timeline set up. He said, "Dick Wilson, please go set up a timeline for the sale of the Pelton Street property." When the community found out about this, there was a lot of outrage in the subsequent months. People came to the city council.
Let me interrupt you for a moment.
Yes.
There was outrage. Why would there be outrage? Is it because perhaps Councilmember Kennedy had adopted a different position when he got the endorsement of the constituents involved? Or what would have caused this outrage?
Well, the outrage started with Catherine Byers and Celia Scott, who were council members at the time, who were not told that this was going to be put up for sale at this time. They were coming into a meeting that they were just shocked at this. You know, it was supposed to be a budget allocation meeting, and here they were just, you know, having to vote on whether or not to set up a timeline to sell the Pelton Street property. So they were completely caught off guard.
Now, is this a subcommittee meeting or an actual city council meeting?
It's an actual city council
meeting.
Are
you saying that it wasn't on the agenda? I mean, certainly would have to have been on the agenda.
It wasn't on the agenda, and you know, we've talked with an attorney, and it is clearly in violation of the Brown Act.
Has any attorney been willing, or has any citizen group been willing to sue the city to demand the process be declared illegal and the matter be resubmitted? Or?
The problem is that the way our laws are set up is you have a very short amount of time with which to press action. There's a statute of limitations on the Brown Act. There's a statute of limitations on a referendum. You have 30 days. And when you talk about a referendum, you need to get 10% of the registered voters. So you're talking about, you know, close to 4,000 signatures, which is a very formidable procedural process.
So in order to challenge this failure to agendize this item, you would have had to have gotten 4,000 votes in 4,000 signatures in 30 days after this happened?
No, that's to change a decision by the council. For a Brown Act violation, we would have had to file in a court of law. But I wasn't in town at the time, and people, when you have a non-agendized item, people are caught off guard. It takes a number of days for the word to get out to the community for people to find out.
The fact of the matter is that attorney Celia Scott made no attempt to file to, overturn the decision of the city council?
At that time, she didn't.
Nor did she go to any of her friends in the legal community to take that action?
No, she didn't. But it was just to set up a timeline. I mean, I'm sure that the thought didn't even cross her mind.
Well, I would think that if the council acted illegally and she had 30 days to reverse it, one would hope the thought would have crossed somebody's mind. And, a legal mind especially would be particularly sensitive to these matters, I would hope. Forgive me for being critical of Celia on this matter. I know she has, in other respects, been quite positive and outspoken. But I think you have to also consider what could have been done and what wasn't done. Go ahead.
Yeah. I think we're all equally responsible, and we're all learning through this process. I know that I've learned a great deal and have made several mistakes out of not understanding the law and the process. And I think that the law is so dense and so thick that it's really difficult, unless you're getting paid by the hour to research these things, to figure it all out. And I think that groups working on initiatives have an obligation to talk to the citizenry and to talk to other groups who are trying to pass initiatives and talk about what they've learned, because we've learned a great deal through this process.
Well, has Celia Scott learned? Have you spoken to her or learned that she regrets not having taken this matter to court initially?
I haven't talked to her about this matter. She's been very supportive and has been very intelligent on a wide range of issues in front of the council, but I have not spoken to her directly about why she did not say that this has been a Brown Act violation.
I'll put through a call to her later and take the flag.
Okay.
Go ahead.
So people started gathering signatures, and you know, the citizenry, not knowing the law, you know, is a bit naive. So 2,500 signatures were gathered by just a couple of citizens and submitted to the city council in June. And
around what issue?
Around stopping the sale of Pelton Street and holding a public hearing and putting the sale to a vote of the people. And the majority of the city council basically said, we don't care how many signatures you get, we're not going to hold a separate public hearing. We basically are not going to budge on this issue.
Can you give us some insight into why the council would do such a thing?
I think that the council, at least the couple of people who are very active on the council and who are really running the show, and by that I mean Mike Rockin and Scott Kennedy, it's basically a study in the pathology of power. And basically they have taken on this paternalistic and highly arrogant stance that they are the only ones that know the right path and the right direction for the city, that their vision is the right vision, and they've developed a really kind of elitist sense of what it means to be a representative. Scott Kennedy on John Laird's Talk of the Bay said, you know, we don't live in a democracy, and he basically just stated that matter-of-factly. And I've had a number of conversations with both Mike and Scott that reveal a really alarming sense of ego and arrogance, and I just think that they really think that most people aren't bright enough to basically have a voice in the shaping their community and in shaping their lives, and that they know the way and it's their way or the highway. And on one level, they were frank about it. They said, you know, we're not going to listen to you, and we don't care how many signatures you get, we don't care what you do, we are in power and we are going to wield that power. And our response was, this is outrageous. We elected you. There's a sacred contract between elected representatives and the citizenry, and you are violating that. And so what we did is we researched the law. We went to the law library. We read, we studied, we wrote an ordinance that would call for the city to rezone this land an urban agricultural overlay. And it would say, before you sell this property that has been a part of this community for four decades, where the homeless garden project has existed, where homeless people have gotten reconnected with this community, learned a valuable skill in growing organic produce and crops, where school children have come to learn about organic gardening, where people of different classes have come together, wealthy people on the west side, homeless people, children, students. It was an amazing place. And what the people who were forwarding this initiative wanted to say is, this is such a vital and important part of this community. Let's stop. Let's take a pause. Let's look at the city budget. Let's look at how much money we have. Because the city council, on every issue, says, you can't oppose our vision of what we need to do. We need the money. We need to pay salaries. We need to do this. We need to do that. And we said, let's take a pause. Let's use this issue to stop and examine the suspicious spending priorities of the city council. Let's educate people and debate about the totality of the city budget and where we're heading as a community.
Do you have any kind of quick overview of the city budget and how and where in fact what direction we are heading in?
I do. To date, City of Santa Cruz has more money than its recorded history. The city manager states, and I recommend that every citizen listening to this program go down to the city hall and get a copy of the 1997-98 final budget. And right in the opening, the city manager states that we have enjoyed an exceptionally strong economy now for a couple of years. The finance department informed me that the city has $4.7 million in the City Public Trust Sky Park, $1.5 million in the Swanton Public Trust, and $176,000 in the Laguna Public Trust. And when you look at the fact that the city council is spending $7 to $11 million on a new police department with an indoor shooting range and a canine unit, and the reason why I say it's $7 to $11 million is because they don't know how much it's going to cost. If you listen to the tape of the city council meeting on January 25th, city staff expressed great concern because at the time the River Street project, where they're building the new Gateway Mall, was running way over cost. And by law, the city has committed to this project, so they're obligated to pay for it no matter how much it costs. And he cited the police building as another example of where the city is committed no matter how much the building costs. You look at the fact that the city's spending a couple million dollars on a new parking structure on Front Street. You look at stores like Costco and Blockbuster coming in, you know, stores like Cymbeline going out. And there's this whole mentality by the council to bring in the chain stores to get the sales tax revenues, to sell land like Pelton Street, and pretty soon we're going to turn into a place like San Jose or Los Gatos. People need to think about why they moved to Santa Cruz. What were the reasons why you moved here and have stayed here all these years? And are we going to allow the city council to permanently alter our community?
Let me ask you something about those two projects, the police department and the Gateway project, because I was at the last city council meeting where indeed there was apparently an attempt to further buttress and insulate the developer from any consequences that the city council, their rash actions and the actions of developing in the face of an initiative that's fighting that development would have. Is it in fact true that the city council gave essentially a blank check and committed themselves to the police department and this Gateway project? Do you have any more specifics on that?
Are you referring to the Gateway project or the Pelton Street?
I'm referring to the Gateway project. You were saying that they were committed to that.
Well, they're committed to the River Street realignment and the costs associated with that.
I'm sorry, I beg your pardon. I guess that's what you were referring
yes,
to.
Yes, that's what I was referring to.
I'm sorry. So what about those two projects?
Well, the police building, I mean, we're going to find out more about it. I've heard that the site that the police building is being built on was a Superfund site. There was it was on an old auto lot, and there was a lot of spilt oil and chemicals. And the argument that the city forwarded was that the toxics were too deep into the ground, and that the use of the police department would not be unearthing them and exposing them to the environment. But there's something that needs to be investigated there. It may be a Superfund site.
There was a similar concern by activist Daniel Hopkins, who opposed the current community house site at River and Highway 1 at Coral Street, where they're now, of course, putting up a $2 million Trailers Not Trolls project, as I call it.
Trailers Not Trolls.
Yes. My question, though, is getting back to what you were saying, do you have any specifics on the kind of blank check that you suggest was given the police department? You're saying not only did they give them a blank check, but they committed themselves to covering that blank check. Any more documentation or research on that? Or?
All that's been said publicly was at that January 25th, 1997 meeting where city staff, in a very concerned voice, says, we are committed to this project no matter how much it costs. So if costs start skyrocketing, they haven't started building the building yet. So we will find out more information once they start building the building. But by law, they are committed to that project, according to city staff.
Yeah, but you haven't done independent research to find out the specifics behind that yet.
No.
Well, we hope that in the future you will give us more details.
Yes, if they're available to the public. But to get back to Pelton Street, so the citizens got together and submitted 2,500 signatures, and the council basically said, we're not going to listen to you. So we researched the law, we wrote this ordinance and initiative, and the beauty of this initiative is that it's highly democratic. At any time, the people of this community can decide to sell that land. If there's an earthquake, if there's some dramatic event in the economy and the city desperately needs money for, you know, publicly approved purposes, the city can vote at any election to sell that land. What we're saying is that residents own this land. It's our land. It's not Mike Rockin or Mike Hernandez or Cynthia Matthews or Mary Beth Campbell or Scott Kennedy's land. They have no right to sell it. without letting the community decide. So we started gathering signatures. We had senior citizens, students, teachers, all sorts of people from all over the city of Santa Cruz coming home after work, after school, and going out to the community and gathering signatures. And let me tell you that going out and gathering signatures really inspired me. We live in a community where there are a number of engaged, intelligent, and creative people. And I always came back from an evening of gathering signatures amazed at what a community that we do have. And I also was instilled and infused with motivation because we deserve better. The people of Santa Cruz want to talk about urban agriculture. They want to talk about land use. They want to talk about the spending priorities of the city. They are very concerned that, especially as you look with this beach area plan with the proposal for a new convention center, that there's going to be more traffic. And what a lot of people are worried about is the cost involved in development, like the luxury homes that are going to be built on Pelton Street, like the beach area plan that calls for a realignment of 3rd Street and the new convention center. There are taxes involved for sewage, for building roads. You know, their property taxes and other taxes are raised. So they were really interested in having a dialogue, having people debate these issues. And so we went to the council and...
They may want a dialogue, but I'm afraid they only get 3 minutes or they have to leave.
Right. That's true.
And of course the issue is 5-2, no matter how long the dialogue goes on, it seems at the present time, or at least that was my constant refrain at this council meeting.
Right.
Throw the bums out.
And so the problem was is that the city council became concerned about the initiative, at least the majority did. And it's very interesting because the city's been playing a shell game. Originally when Scott Kennedy made the motion to have the city manager provide a timeline for the sale of the property back in January of 1997, he said that the proceeds from the sale of Pelton Street, $500,000 would go to renovate the Poganip Clubhouse, $200,000 would go for recreational facilities and a soccer field in Arana Gulch. That proved to be very politically unpalatable. So as our initiative started gaining momentum, Michael Hernandez, Mike Rockin, and Scott Kennedy said, oh, we're going to use some of the money for the green belt. So we see them trying to insulate themselves politically after voting against using money from the sale of the Pelton Street for the green belt twice. All of a sudden, as our initiative starts gaining momentum, they start playing the shell game about what the money is being spent for.
Well, can't politicians change their minds? I mean, are you suggesting this is an insincere action that once they stop the initiative, then they'll quickly shift it back again to projects that they are in favor? Is that your suggestion?
No, I'm not suggesting that at all. Politicians are very able to change their mind. I'm just asking the citizens to think about it. You know, the city council is claiming we need the money. My question is, the money for what? Let's look at what we're spending our money on. Do we really want a Taj Mahal for a police department that we don't know how much it's going to cost, that we've, at minimum estimate, is $7 million?
Might be better to train them not to shoot people on the mall.
Yes, of course we don't want police officers shooting people on the mall. But it's important because when the city council put this land up for bid for only 2 weeks, there were several offers in just 2 weeks. There are people dying to develop this land. It is a steal. And the city originally was going to sell them as individual lots. And there's a letter that Norman Schwartz, the representative from Bolton Hill, who's consulting the city on these matters, said that, you know, of course the city would make more money selling individual lots, but in the interest of time and speed, we should sell it in one bulk. And what are the interests of time and speed? The only interest in time and speed, the city's owned the property for 40 years, is this initiative. And so it's a direct example of the city circuit.
The initiative to take the issue out of their hands and
put
and
into
stop
the people.
Them from selling it.
Exactly. So before they decided to take Pacific Union Homes as the developer, we met in a special session with the council. We pulled them out of closed session and met with them. We had over 3,500 signatures right there, and we said, we're going to qualify for this ballot. Do not pick a developer. Do not sell this land. They picked Pacific Union Homes, and they said escrow was going to close in February. The way election law works is that election code section 9215 says that you need to get 10% of the registered voters to qualify your initiative. Once you qualify, the city council has two options. Either they can adopt the initiative into law, or they can put it to a vote of the people. 10% of the Santa Cruz registered voters is 3,800 voters. Before the close of escrow, we turned in over 5,600 signatures of residents of the city of Santa Cruz.
So you were able to surpass your margin by, it sounds like, almost 2,000 votes.
Yes, 150%. And the city council decided to proceed against the will of the people, even though at that time they would have only had to wait 3 months till the June election to let people vote. So after owning this property for 40 years, after all of the community uses for this property, the national recognition of the Homeless Garden Project, the fact that thousands of city residents had not only signed this petition, but if you look at the city record, 100% of the calls into the mayor and the city council's office said, do not sell this land. 99% of the over 200 people that testified on this issue in the last year said, don't sell the land. So the question becomes, who does this council or the majority of this council represent? And so what happened was they closed escrow, and the developer got scared because we turned in 5,600 signatures, and their attorneys constructed and crafted this development agreement, which would vest their property rights, and they crafted it in the form of an ordinance. Now, Section 5.2 of this development agreement, I urge every citizen listening to this program to go get a copy of this development agreement. Section 5.2 states that the city shall not support any future ordinance, and that the city council will take our tax dollars and use them to pay half of the legal fees for an out-of-town, multi-million dollar corporate developer in a lawsuit against the citizens of Santa Cruz. And let me repeat that. Section 5.2 states that the city council is going to use our tax dollars to pay for half of the legal fees of a wealthy, out-of-town corporate developer. This is outrageous. This is an abuse of power. And I walked up to Scott Kennedy. When you have an ordinance, it has to go before the public twice. There's two readings of it. So at the first reading, a few weeks ago, the council voted 5-2 with Mike Rockin, Michael Hernandez, Scott Kennedy, Cynthia Matthews, and Mary Beth Campbell voting for the development agreement, and Celia Scott and Catherine Byers voting against the development agreement.
Four of those five votes were Scan-endorsed candidates at the last elections, right?
I believe that. And Celia Scott said the development agreement was egregious.